Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, December 18th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. For our final podcast episode of 2023, I'm sharing a conversation about a jarring spike in migrant deaths along the southern New Mexico border. Reporter Laura Villagran spent a year investigating the situation for the El Paso Times. Executive producer Jeff Proctor asks Villagran and photojournalist Omar Ornelas about what pushed them to pursue the story and what they found. That's in less than 5 minutes, after some state headlines. Today, December 18th, is the final day to submit comments to the State Public Education Department about its proposed calendar change. That's ahead of an in-person public comment session tonight in Santa Fe. We've told you about the department's proposed rule change that would dedicate a minimum of 180 days to student instruction and limit 4-day school weeks. PED Secretary Arsenio Romero presented the plan during a budget proposal presentation to the Legislative Finance Committee late last week. According to the Albuquerque Journal, Romero defended the proposed rule, emphasizing its goal to enhance instructional time and recover lost hours. Lawmakers argued that the rule contradicts House Bill 130, signed by the governor earlier this year. That bill increased instructional hours. If approved, the rule would take effect in the next school year. James Mountain, the governor's controversial appointee for Secretary of the State Indian Affairs Department, is stepping down. A spokesperson for the governor announced the move late last week. Mountain had been serving as secretary designate because the Lujan Grisham administration never scheduled a confirmation hearing for him in front of the state Senate. Members of the state's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force criticized Lujan Grisham for appointing Mountain in the first place. That's after Bella Davis of New Mexico In-Depth reported on 2008 criminal charges against Mountain, including criminal sexual penetration, kidnapping, and aggravated battery against a household member. Those charges were later dropped. Deputy Secretary Josette Monette will now serve as the Indian Affairs Cabinet Secretary. Monette is a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and she said in a statement that she takes on the role with a commitment to tribal relationships and overseeing New Mexico's investments in tribal communities. Mountain will remain with the administration, too, in a newly created position of Senior Policy Advisor for Tribal Affairs. That job does not require legislative confirmation. A northern New Mexico landowner has agreed to allow more than 3,500 acres of his land to be used for a migration route for elk. Stan Rule, an avid hunter, voluntarily partnered with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation to prevent his property in Armago Canyon from being split up and future development. The agreement will maintain the natural state of the property. Rule says that supports his vision of a family legacy instead of potentially reselling the property. 50 to 75 elk live on that land, and it's also a critical migration route, reaching elevations of up to 9,000 feet and offering diverse habitats. Rule isn't just leaving the land be, either. He's planted food plots and maintained water sources, which the foundation says aligns with the broader goal of ensuring connectivity for migrating wildlife. Founded in 1984, RMFE has over 240 nationwide conservation agreements. Now, here's executive producer Jeff Proctor's interview with reporter Laura Villagran and photographer Omar Ornelas about the spike in migrant deaths along the southern New Mexico border.
As we just heard from Lou, readers are finally getting a look at the first few installments of your series on migrant deaths. And there's a lot that I'd like to get to in what will not be enough time. Y'all have worked on these stories for a year. And I'd like to rewind the clock just a bit. Omar, where did the reporting begin?
Well, when we initially responded to the fire on the 27th of March, it was a Monday, like any regular day. And some of our colleagues here in Juarez had mentioned that there had been a fire and there may be a possibility of two or three deaths. So that sort of alarm kind of, got my interest as a journalist to see what would happen if the information was relatively coming in. So a couple of other more calls, a couple more information. They said possibly seven bodies had been taken out of the building. That became a really concern for me, and immediately, I headed down to the migrant detention center. And as I arrived, one of the first things that just was traumatic is that by the time I got there, I was probably maybe 45 minutes into the fire, there was probably already about 15 or a dozen bodies laid in the front, and as first responders and military were taking out the bodies. So that's how this reporting kind of initially for me began, with something that was very powerful. But I like to kind of, you know, go talk a little bit about what preceded that. And then a week before that, there had been a group of migrants that had approached the International Bridge Paso del Norte for about 500 people. And so we had already seen on the streets that it was something was boiling up. There was something definitely happening with the desperation of the migrants not being able to be processed for asylum. We had seen a lot of tension between migrants and the civic society in Juarez, and the response of it was one of tension. And on the 13th of March, just a couple weeks before the tragedy, the mayor of Juarez, Cruz Perez Cuellar, made a statement where he said that the patience was running out. So this was on the 13th of March. So we knew that this, we were observing something that was already boiling up within what was happening on the streets and with the tensions of so many migrants trying to be processed for asylum. And so when this happened, I really think, we could never have imagined that it would have, something like of this magnitude would have happened. But certainly it didn't surprise that something this tragic was going to happen. So again, I mean, I think it was something that that as unimaginable as you can imagine, 40 people died in a fire. It really just kind of was something that for all journalists in the area began to say, why did this happen? And I think that's why I kind of talked about a little bit about what preceded that, because there were so many things that were happening in regards to policy at the local level, at the state level, and certainly internationally.
Lauren, what did you want to learn about the 40 men who died in that fire? And what did you want your readers to know about them?
Yeah, Jeff, well, as with any mass tragedy, such as a mass shooting in the US, like the one that occurred here in El Paso in August of 2019, when you have this large number of victims, the first thing we ask ourselves as journalists is, who were they? I'm afraid that often, people who are in a process of migrating are often written off as migrants and not looked at as whole people who, have lives and families and dreams that are left behind. And so we wanted to ask, who were the men who died? And of course, what were the circumstances that led us to follow the beginning of court testimony in Mexican federal court, and also to start searching for the men who died? In doing that, I came across a report in a major Guatemalan newspaper that mapped the 19 Guatemalan men, like where they were from. And I noticed that five of the men were all from the same state. And when I started to make the inquiry and reached out to a local community journalist, Antonio Shosh, it turned out that five of the men were actually from the same collection of villages near a place called La Ceiba. And so, we wanted to go down and find out more about them.
So once the story sort of moved beyond that tragedy and piecing together who those people were, what did you learn about the number of migrant deaths during the time period that you examined?
Yeah, so this began as a singular project around the fire at the Juarez Detention Center. But what we didn't know was that 2023 was going to become the deadliest year at the El Paso Juarez border and in southern New Mexico since public record keeping began 25 years ago. We're talking, Jeff, about, a record of six people dying 6 years ago, according to Border Patrol statistics. And this summer it was 149, the vast majority died in the desert areas right around Sunland Park and in Doñana County in southern New Mexico. So it became clear to us that what, my colleague Omar was talking about in terms of the tensions and the number of people that that were flocking to Juarez at this time earlier in the year, that continued through the year. And it really took us by surprise. It took immigrant advocates. It even took the Border Patrol by surprise, because this region had really never seen anything like it.
So in the story that published yesterday in the El Paso Times, one of the central characters In that piece of reporting was a woman named Laura Mae Williams of the Office of the Medical Investigator here in New Mexico, here at the University of New Mexico. Omada, I'm particularly interested in what you saw, what you documented in the course of spending time with Laura Mae in the field. What was her work like?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that Laura Mae is just a phenomenal person. I think it's her approach to her work was just from, a humane perspective. And I think that's what I most learned from her was, you know, how her focus was like, this is a humanity. This is a humane issue. Her main objective was to dignify the death of these individuals. And many times we never find out who their identity. So I think her process was, thought, a friend of mine of thinking of how would I like to be treated or my loved ones to be treated. And so I think that was something that really kind of moved me from her work. And in doing so, in having an opportunity to follow her through some of the work that she did, it was just, you know, seeing how meticulous she was and how, you know, the objective of making sure that she was, documenting the details that, you know, in our reporting, we knew were essential for a family member in the future to be able to identify some of these dead. So I think that seeing somebody like Laura Mae work in the field just kind of like really brought the attention to me, or just the perspective of how much humanity it requires for somebody to do this. And it was overwhelming, certainly in her, you know, in our conversations, and how she would speak about, you know, there were days where she wouldn't stop. It would not stop. It was just body after body after body in the desert. And yet, you know, she still remained steadfast in keeping, her main objective, which is, again, to give some dignity to these type of deaths are certainly horrible.
Lauren, who were among the dead? What do you know about them? And maybe as importantly, what don't you know about them?
Right. So the Office of the Medical Investigator, who Laura Mae Williams works for, is the forensic investigator that goes out on the scene to process the body, try to identify the person. The Office of the Medical Investigator in New Mexico is taking a leadership role this year in creating a new box to check called probable border crosser, so they can begin to track and identify probable migrants who have died. The majority, Jeff, we don't know who they are. And OMI, that Office of the Medical Investigator, is dealing with an extraordinary number of unidentified bodies this year of likely migrants. We do know who some of them are, though. Angelica Sales Morales from Guatemala, her remains were found, sadly, in near Sunland Park, New Mexico, while the detectives and Border Patrol were investigating her death and her body. There was a fanny pack near her and a cell phone inside it. It rang and the detective answered it. And it turned out it was a family member from Guatemala who helped identify her. I mean, it's dramatic stories like that. There's another woman, Arelis Chavez Bueno, who three motorcyclists who were out in the Santa Teresa area of Doñana County. They were, you know, riding around, for recreation and stumbled on a body of a woman named Arelis Chavez Bueno. We don't know her nationality. There's another woman, Emiliana Ruiz Juarez, who was still alive when Border Patrol found her unconscious in a Sunland Park neighborhood. Someone had reported her death and had tried to give her water, but believed she was in the process of dying. I mean, what's been really dramatic, Jeff, is that we're not talking about people dying in the middle of a vast desert. We're talking about people who managed to scale the 30-foot border fence and began a trek that is really not more than a mile or 2 miles from the border fence into neighborhoods, near schools or a highway. And yet they were collapsing and dying, many of heat-related illnesses through the summer, at a rate, as Omar mentioned, of like sometimes two or three per day.
And I will say that struck me very much in reading your stories. What also struck me, among the other things that struck me, was how these people died. You mentioned heat. I'm not asking you to get too terribly graphic here, but how did these folks die? What does heat like that do to the human body?
Yeah, you know, I reached out to University Medical Center in El Paso to get a better understanding and spoke to a doctor who often treats heat-related illnesses through the summer, both of residents and, you know, when they are caught in time, migrants. And, you know, he just described how heat can basically begin to shut down the human body. Now, one thing we have to remember is that many of these migrants, Jeff, are being walked through the desert on the Mexican side, sometimes for 5 or 6 hours. They are already in poor condition. Many are in the hands of smugglers who may not have fed them for days. They're not in good health or in good condition when they found themselves this summer in, you know, the Chihuahuan Desert of southern New Mexico, when temperatures were well over 100 degrees. Laura Mae Williams takes the temperature of both the air and the ground when she finds a body. Jeff, her thermometer hit a maximum of 150 degrees. The sand in that area was 150 degrees. You know, so the body begins to sweat. It begins to try to cool itself off. The normal human response is to seek shelter or shade. In this area, there is none. There's mesquite, there's creosote. But again, we're talking about a desert where the heat is coming up from below and from above. And the organs begin to shut down. It's, you know, I can only imagine that it's a horrible death. And in the case of migrants, many times groups will continue on and leave a person behind. And at that point, it's usually too late.
So I don't want to derail the conversation or distract from the incredible human stories that y'all have documented by veering into a big policy discussion. But what have you learned in the course of your reporting about why we are seeing this huge spike in migrant deaths in the El Paso sector?
You know, when we talk about this, is what pushes these people. Certainly when we discussed the beginning of this, you know, the project, you know, we talked about policy. And we talked about policy, not just from the United States, but also from Mexico. And in doing that, we saw that at least, you know, reporting on the ground in Juarez, as I mentioned earlier, people didn't have an option. People didn't have an option to turn themselves in at a port of entry or elsewhere. And it just started the accumulation of people living in a city that wasn't in many ways welcoming them, caused many of them to resort to these type of you know, unsafe passages. So, for example, in Ciudad Juarez, you know, once they realized that they weren't going to be there, that it's an unsafe city, some of them resorted to crossing towards the east, excuse me, to the west of Juarez, which is also what is in the Sunland area or Anapra. Typically, it's known as one of the most dangerous areas in Juarez. It's where human smuggling occurs. So we saw it. We saw a direct, attempt from migrants that had become obviously disillusioned with the opportunity to come in and seeing them going, using some of these other alternate routes that ultimately cost their lives. So I think that you could see that from the local in the state and the federal government, at least in Mexico, that it was not welcoming to many of the migrants, and certainly it wasn't providing the necessary shelter and the necessary structure for them to wait in Mexico, which is what the United States was asking them. You have to wait and apply for the CBP-1, as we know from the many reporting, is that it's not very efficient, and it certainly caused a lot of despair. And from our reporting, I think that we can see that many of these migrants opted for much more dangerous, and again, it ended up in costing their lives.
That's the phone app you're talking about, right?
Correct. So the CBP-1 app, where, you know, they would wait for an appointment where they could present themselves at a port of entry and then be accepted for processing for asylum. For many of these migrants, it's just the waiting was too long. The alternative was staying in an unsafe city, like I mentioned, a city that certainly was showing that it wasn't welcoming, and it certainly didn't have the resources to provide for these migrants. So I think and ultimately what we're seeing is this continues. It hasn't stopped. Here we are at the end of the year, and just yesterday We had a 1,000 migrants that, you know, arrived in the city of Juarez and crossed the river past this concertina wire and are being processed. So it just continues. It hasn't stopped. And unfortunately, we likely will continue seeing migrants dying along the border between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez.
What can readers expect as the series continues? I won't ask you to tip your hand too much, but what else can we expect to see in terms of what you found in this year of reporting?
Yeah, so, you know, we've covered the Juarez migrant fire. We covered, the problems that Southern New Mexico is seeing in the Santa Teresa and Sunland Park area of Doñana County, as well as what water managers who manage the waters of the Rio Grande have had to contend with in terms of drownings in the river. And we'll also see additional stories from Arizona, where we have colleagues who have put together stories that look at solutions. Arizona, as you know, has contended with migrant deaths, a very high level of migrant deaths for almost two decades, and has developed a variety of, if not solutions to migration and, you know, unsafe migration, certainly different ways of tracking migrant deaths, of communicating and finding families. There are partnerships between Pima County in Arizona and a nonprofit that I think we're going to learn a lot from. We're also going to have a story from our colleague Aline Zimmerman out of Juarez, looking at the problem from the Mexican side. And I really hope that it will continue to be a subject that that we'll continue to look at. As Omar mentioned, you know, the issue doesn't end. And one thing that I think is important to continue to evaluate and analyze is the U.S. deterrence approach at the border. We're about 30 years into deterrence efforts. And I think that hopefully some of our reporting is going to shed light on border policies as, you know, we head into an election year.
Thank you both so much for coming on my show this week. And thanks a ton for the continued work.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks to Jeff for that interview and to Lauren and Omar for making time to speak with us. And of course, thank you for listening. Be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our shows on Friday nights. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio. For Monday, December 18th, 2023, this is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week and a happy holiday season, everyone. We'll see you next year.